Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, for most Americans, World War II ended in August of 1945 with the surrender of Japan. Yet on the mainland of Asia, peace was only a very brief interlude. In fact, in the years following the war, many people suffered far more than during the war itself. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with historian Ronald Spector about his recent book. The title is In the Ruins of Empire, The Japanese Surrender and the Battle for Post-War Asia. It is published by Random House, and it takes a look at the experience, particularly in four countries where, after the surrender, things went horribly wrong, giving birth, in some cases, to long-term problems that certainly survived long after World War II. In fact, some of them even outlived the Cold War. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions, comments are welcome. Our guest is Professor of History and International Relations at George Washington University, where he teaches courses on U.S. East Asia relations, on World War II and the Vietnam War. He has been also a guest professor in Tokyo. He has, he served in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War. He was a distinguished professor of strategy at the National War College in Washington, and he is the author of six previous books, including Eagle Against the Sun, The American War with Japan. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who would like to call in is 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. Certainly, callers are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people are brief in their comments, and we ask that so we can keep moving, get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Spector, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a very broad story, and I am certain that one could, and in fact people have, written entire books about the experience in just one of these places that you write about, China, Korea, Vietnam, Indonesia, and so forth. Having said that, and noting that in each one of these places there is a distinct story, is it possible to say something that is, in terms of a general overarching story here, that is going to have some validity no matter what individual country you're talking about?
Well, I tried to determine why some of the focus was on military occupations, and I tried to determine why some of the occupations were real disasters and some of them went okay, and one or two of them ended satisfactorily, at least in the sense that the occupying power was able to leave without any fuss and violence, something that is looking better and better in the perspective of Iraq today.
Hmm. Well, give an example of one of those places where things worked out reasonably well and the occupying power was then able to leave, and perhaps one would say that the conditions in the country were better than they had been before.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we can say the conditions were better in any of these countries in many senses than they had been before. They were, I think, in a material sense, since many of these countries were on the verge of starvation at the end of World War II, at the end of the Japanese occupation, because the Japanese had basically requisitioned large numbers of food supplies. But in the kind of overall political and social sense, I'm not sure that any of them benefited from the occupation. What happened in some countries is that certain political factions were able to take advantage of the occupation, work out deals with the occupying authorities, and advance their cause. And in countries where those factions were devoted to independence, then that worked in favor of the independence of those countries.
Hmm. It seems that one theme here is that after the war ended, the Japanese were defeated in Southeast Asia, East and Southeast Asia. There was a power vacuum. With the Japanese gone, and the former colonial powers here who were interested in getting back in control hadn't really had the chance to do that, that there then was perhaps people in the region saw this as maybe a one-time opportunity for those people who were interested in and perhaps even prepared to fight for independence to get set up to do that. Do you see that as being a larger kind of theme here that gets repeated from one place to another?
In almost all of these countries, all of the major actors, the political contenders, so to speak, ethnic groups, political movements, all of them, first of all, saw this as an opportunity, and they're also very conscious that there's a very short time limit here, a very short window of opportunity between the Japanese surrender and the time that the Allied occupiers are going to arrive. So they're trying to take advantage of that short window of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. It seems that here, as far as the Allies were concerned, that there are perhaps two kinds of orientations, in the sense that we have countries like Britain and France that had been colonial powers who were apparently interested in reestablishing themselves, and in a sense they wanted to get back to the status quo ante, that they wanted to go back to what had been before the war and before the Japanese had then occupied so much territory. And then on the other side, there was the United States and the Soviet Union that were, in a sense, looking, it seems already they were looking forward to the Cold War. Perhaps you'd have to count at least the communist Chinese as well as having a different kind of frame of reference. In a sense, everybody was interested in staking out territory, but I suppose it depended upon whether what you thought was going to happen, whether we were going back to what we had before or whether we were going into some kind of new age where we really truly were going to talk about superpower competition and a new kind of geopolitical reality.
Yes, well, all the occupying countries knew that the situation was fluid, that is, that there were opportunities and dangers here. They might be able to improve their position. As you say, some of them hoped that they could get back to the good old days, but as it turned out, another big factor was the question of how long they could keep their troops in the area, because just as today there's a lot of demand to bring the troops home, that was certainly true in Britain at the end of World War II and in the United States. There were many questions asked in Congress, for instance, about why were the Marines still in China a year after Japan surrendered.
Well, I'm sure that they felt that the troops, and I imagine it was not just American troops that felt that way, that all of the Allied troops, the British and the Australians and the Indians and the Russians and the Americans, everybody, when the end of the war came, I'm sure that a lot of them were saying, you know, great, now let's go home. And we're probably disappointed, to say the least, when a lot of them were told, no, you can't go home right now. We have to go into secure this territory. You know, the Russians, they were interested in China and in Manchuria and in the areas the Japanese had occupied, and the United States was involved in China as well, and that the French and the British were in Southeast Asia, and that everybody was having to, in a sense, keep advancing rather than have this quick kind of demobilization where all the Allied troops got to go home. I'm sure that there were there on the troops' point of view that there was a great deal of unhappiness about that.
Yes, and there were varying pressures at home to bring the troops home. Of course, in Russia, there wasn't any domestic pressure to bring the troops home since they didn't allow any domestic dissent. Some of the Russian troops were surprised that the countries, the parts of China that they were occupying, the parts of Korea they were occupying, actually seemed to have a higher standard of living than the Soviet Union did. And they thought that that was rather unfair since they were the ones who were liberating the country. They were the ones who had defeated the Japanese. And so, as I describe in the book, they proceeded to try to even the odds, so to speak, by scooping up whatever they could from the local civilian population. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ronald Spector. He's professor of history and international relations at George Washington University, has written a good deal about the history of World War II in East Asia, and is the author of a new book. It's titled In the Ruins of Empire, The Japanese Surrender and the Battle for Postwar Asia. That's the subtitle. It's published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that I was surprised at was, and you write about here in the book, that there was a very large number of Japanese, both soldiers and civilians, who were scattered out now throughout East and Southeast Asia, outside of Japan, on the Asian mainland, and also in the Western Pacific. It seems like a staggering number. At the end of the war, one out of every 20 Japanese was living outside of Japan?
That's right. Now, the great majority, of course, were living in places like China and Korea, but of course, they also had to garrison all those Pacific islands and the Marianas and the Carolines and so on. And many of these island bases had not been attacked. They'd been bypassed by the Allies in the advance across the Pacific, and then there were sizable numbers of Japanese also in Southeast Asia. And, of course, the question was what to do about them. Would they put up a fight? Because they really, most of them hadn't been defeated. They had never been in a real battle with the Allies in, say, Indonesia or Indochina. And even if they wouldn't put up a fight, how to get them all home?
Particularly, how did when the war was over, how did these people fare, particularly in their relations with the local people that they had previously occupied, now that the status had changed?
Well, there were instances in all countries where people settled old scores, so to speak. There weren't any massacres of former Japanese occupiers, maybe because most of the Japanese occupiers retained their arms and they were still in discipline units. That most of the occupied people were glad to see the Japanese go, although a few of them who'd established good relations with people like teachers or bosses at their places of work actually said they were sorry to see some of these people leave. But in general, there was very little regret at the Japanese going, and in many cases, Japanese houses were looted. The Japanese themselves were sort of robbed of everything that they had and treated not very well by the former subject occupation.
Yeah, well, it certainly seemed that in a lot of places there was, a kind of a scramble for resources or for whatever there was of value. That I'm sure that what happened when the Japanese came in is they started out by essentially appropriating everything that, or a lot of things that were of value. And then when the war was over, they were no longer the occupying power, even if they had some opportunity to defend themselves. I'm sure the same thing happened again. There was a great deal of scrambling, in this case, I suppose, by the formerly occupied people, scrambling for control of whatever were the valuable resources that were at hand.
That's right, and especially in China and Manchuria, there was an enormous amount of wealth. There was the money in Japanese banks. There were dozens and dozens of businesses and factories. There were the homes and the property occupied by the Japanese. The Japanese also, of course, managed and owned many of the railways. So there was a good deal for the occupying Soviet soldiers and the nationalist Chinese to pick up from the surrendered Japanese.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Batavia. This is our line 4 up in the northern part of the state. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Yes.
Great topic. I was wondering, though, there's a topic of conversation lately comparing, you know, Vietnam War to the Iraq War. And I was wondering if there's some close comparisons there. And also, it seems to me like every time there's an end of a war, we spend a lot of money and a lot of manpower rebuilding these countries we go in and bomb. And I was just curious, is there any kind of total figure of what we spent on both Germany and Japan and how much money and, you know, what we spent to rebuild their infrastructure?
I don't know what it is. I'm sure that they have figures like that. Of course, a great deal was, and it was a big figure, of course, a great deal was also invested in the rebuilding of Western Europe in the so-called Marshall Plan. There wasn't much American direct aid to Southeast Asia until about 49-50 after the so-called fall of China, and that's when you first get the first American direct aid to these countries like Indonesia, Thailand, Indochina, but not before that time.
Do you see history repeating itself here? I mean, it looks to me like we're spending tons of money on rebuilding a place that we go in and blow up. And it seems to me, I look at it this way, it's like history repeating itself here.
You know, well, one of the things that the South Vietnamese always believed, even after the Americans withdrew all their combat troops after 73, they believed that the Americans had made such a huge investment in South Vietnam, had built these expensive airfields, a huge port complex, that the Americans couldn't possibly just leave this, so that if there was really a danger that South Vietnam was going to fall to the communists, the Americans would come back in to sort of safeguard their investment. And, of course, that didn't happen.
Thanks, guys. Have a great afternoon.
Well, thank you. Well, do you, as you write in the introduction to the book, that you write that this story that we're talking about and you write about in the book is a story about military occupations and their consequences. I'm sure that that invites the question of the military occupation in which we're involved now and whether there are lessons to be taken from this period after World War II that perhaps either we should have learned before going into Iraq, or that we should make sure that now, if there are lessons to be learned, we take them with us to whatever we do in the future.
Yes, that's true. I think that the one sort of bottom line lesson is that military occupations are very iffy, and the chances of success are not high. And I think that by looking at Germany and Japan, that people often got the wrong idea. And the other thing that emerges from my book that's fairly obvious now in the light of the Iraq experience is that it's a very bad idea to undertake these occupations of areas that you know nothing about and where you don't send sufficient troops to really carry out the policy of your country.
And was this generally the case in Asia after the war? That is, where there were occupations, the people who went in really didn't know much about the people that they were occupying?
No, they didn't. They knew very little. The exceptions probably were the British in Malaya, who knew. Of course, Malaya had been a British colony, but even there, the British had most of the experienced British civil servants from Malaya had been in Japanese prison camps, and they just went home. They didn't go back to Malaya, so they had lots of inexperienced, brand new people there. And of course, in the case of Korea, the Americans had probably less than a dozen people who even in the occupation force initially who even spoke Korean. So there was this very broad and general ignorance of most of these areas. The one exception probably was China, because the Americans have been involved in China for a long time. A large percentage of the senior Marine officers who went to China with the initial group of Marines had been in China one or two times before. Some Marine officers and NCOs actually spoke Chinese. So that was the exception. But in general, there was just very widespread ignorance of where they were going.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the motivation of the occupying powers, was it the case that are there in some senses, in some cases where people had maybe some kind of very ambitious agenda, where they maybe even thought I'm sure rightly corrected me that there probably weren't, it wasn't any place where things were better after the occupation than before. There certainly were places where the things were worse after the occupation than before, but was there a difference in what the occupying powers, the Western powers, thought they were doing, and in terms of either thinking that they would had this idea that things could be better, or were there cases where they went in just and basically their idea was to make sure that the place was stable, that they addressed issues like allied prisoners of war, getting the Japanese out of there, and just in a sense leaving things in basically stable condition when they left?
Well, there were countries in each category. In the case of Indonesia, for instance, the British wanted to turn that over to the Dutch as soon as possible, get the round up the Japanese, disarm them, send them home, case was the same in Indochina. And in the case of China, the U.S. had a very ambitious agenda for China, but it was basically a continuation of pre-war American policy, and the specific reason for sending military forces there as opposed to just sending lots of money and aid and technical advice that the U.S. had been providing to Chiang Kai-shek's government was to deal with the Japanese. That was a specific reason that they were there, and also maybe to deter the Russians from moving into China. So the U.S. had a program for pretty clear program for China, but it was not necessarily tied to the occupation. And in the case of Korea, there was a kind of plan that was worked out eventually during the course of the first year, but they never coordinated it very well with the what the occupying forces were doing. So it varied from place to place. Of course, the Russians had a very positive plan. They knew exactly what they wanted to achieve in northern Korea and in Manchuria.
Just to make a comparison between how the United States approached how the United States thought about the future of these countries, particularly Southeast Asia, and how particularly Britain and France thought about the same thing, and I don't want to make anybody sound either better or worse than they were, but it seems that one could at least say of the United States that there was this intention of moving. It might have been a slow movement, but moving towards independence, and that it was something for these countries, many of these countries, and it seemed that it was something that the French and the British, that wasn't on their agenda at all.
Well, the certainly in the case of the French and the Dutch, they had no plans for independence. They had certain reforms that they said they were going to carry out that would make the government better, more responsive to the people, but they certainly weren't thinking in terms of independence. The British were thinking about independence, at least in principle, because they knew that they were going to have to give independence to India fairly soon. And, of course, the Americans had already given independence to the Philippines almost as soon as the war was over. And the Philippines had been self-governing even before Pearl Harbor. They had been set up as kind of a self-governing commonwealth. So it varied from one country to another. The U.S., in principle, was opposed to all this colonialism of the European variety, and in principle was in favor of independence for these countries. But most Americans felt this was not a job that the U.S. Ought to do, that it wasn't our job to win independence for these countries, even though we might like to see it. And then there was a great deal of questioning in the minds of many Americans as to whether these people were ready for independence. That was a phrase that was used a lot. Are they ready for independence? There was this idea that you had to reach a certain level of political development and so on before you could be independent. Of course, local people weren't particularly interested in that. They wanted independence now, and they were sure that they were ready.
Yeah, there seemed there certainly is was a very striking passage here where it quotes some of the thinking in the West about the potential for independence, particularly in Southeast Asia, that shows a what seems to us today a shocking level of racism and insensitivity in the kind of paternal attitude that it takes, even going as far as to say, you know, something like, well, you know, people who live in hot countries, this thing that really seems quite silly when you look at it, you know, people who are saying things like with a straight face, well, you know, democracy, you can't really expect that to flourish in a tropical country. There just seemed to be really a shocking level of that kind of stuff, even at this point that we're talking about in the, you know, the mid to late 1940s.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's a great deal of kind of geographical determinism and racial determinism that enters into these conversations quite naturally. That is, they're, from our point of view, people are thinking in very politically incorrect ways, but many people genuinely believed that there was a kind of hierarchy of races, or so to speak. They really meant ethnic groups and countries, but at any rate, there was this hierarchy of countries and peoples, and only when you got to the top of the ladder, so to speak, did you deserve to be self-governing.
We're just a little bit past our midpoint here. I have several callers we will get to in just a moment, but I do want to introduce again the guest for this hour, Ronald Spector. He's professor of history and international relations at George Washington University, where he teaches on U.S. East Asia relations, World War II, and the Vietnam War. He was a distinguished professor of strategy at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a number of books. He's written a lot about World War II in the Pacific. His books include Eagle Against the Sun, The American War with Japan, and a book that is perhaps something of a sequel to that, taking a look at what happened in South East Asia and East Asia After the War, and that book has recently been published. The title is In the Ruins of Empire, The Japanese Surrender and the Battle for Post-War Asia, published by Random House. And in this book, he makes the point that in his introduction that perhaps, and as much as Americans thought about the war essentially being over when the Japanese surrendered, that is, for the mainland of Asia, peace in many places was rather short-lived, and in fact, in some places, people experienced greater levels of disruption and violence than they had experienced during the war. There were some places where, in fact, during the war, essentially there was no fighting at all, like Vietnam, which later, of course, became much more problematic. Questions here, welcome. We have several callers in line ready to go. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling on a cell phone, someone in Champaign, so we'll go right there. That's line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting program. Just two quick questions, and I'll go ahead and ring off. It seems to me, and I don't know if there's any truth to this, that I had read some time ago that immediately after the war, Ho Chi Minh approached the West and a fledgling United Nations out in San Francisco, asking them for assistance in becoming independent. And he was summarily dismissed and consequently turned his allegiance to China. And the consequences, we're all aware of what happened after that. So I was wondering if there was any truth to that. And then the other one is, it's not Asia, but I was wondering if your guest had any background as to the rather brutal occupation by the French paratroopers of Algeria. And I believe that was right after the war, somewhere in around the early 50s. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
All right. You want to talk a little bit about Ho Chi Minh and Vietnam?
Well, yes, that became a very well-known tale. Of course, during the Vietnam War, Ho Chi Minh had made a lot of overtures to American representatives in northern Vietnam, where he had set up his Democratic Republic of Vietnam immediately after the Japanese surrender. And the individual Americans were very sympathetic, but the government in Washington was not interested in this. I don't think they paid much attention to it. And, of course, there was a concern not to aggravate the French over what looked like a very obscure and minor issue. So the French said that Indochina belonged to them and they would take care of its internal problems. And the U.S. pretty much accepted that, at least on the official level.
All right. And I would assume that you would beg off on the question about Algeria.
Yeah, I think I'd beg off on that, except for one observation, and that is that the French in Algeria were really fighting for a country that they said was part of France, and they were fighting an insurrection on the part of people who wanted Algeria to be independent. So it wasn't exactly the same situation.
All right,
as an occupation.
Let's talk with someone in Belgium, not too far away from us, over by Danville, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I've recently noticed a phenomenon that I wondered was it all prevalent after World War II in Southeast Asia. After here recently, I've been noticing a lot of advertising, a lot of information being put to us about Cambodia, especially Angkor Wat, because of its worldwide, you know, historical type situation. I have a son who's a bit of a globetrotter, and he's going there recently, very shortly. And it seems like that's a place I never wanted to go. Obviously, being a Vietnam era individual, I had no desire to go to Cambodia. But now tourism seems to be something that is really strong in Southeast Asia. Vietnam is getting to be more and more popular. Cambodia is very popular. Myanmar or Burma doesn't seem to be doing too well, nor Laos, but Thailand is. Was there such a thing after World War II? I don't ever remember many people wanting to travel to the Southeast Asia after World War II.
Yes, I think you're right. They didn't have any tourist boom in regard to Asia after World War II, and that was primarily because it was extremely expensive. I mean, it basically entailed going by ship, and that alone was expensive. And then when you got there, it was very expensive and time consuming to tour everywhere. So we've really had a kind of revolution in tourism, along with all these other phenomena of globalization. Lots of college kids and recent college graduates can take their backpack and get a cut-rate fare to Vietnam or Thailand or Cambodia, and can pretty much make their own way around without paying for a $500 a day tour. So it's kind of a different, completely different setup. When the Marines went to China, as I note in my book, they were real unhappy because they weren't going home. On the other hand, many of them said, whoa, well, when would we ever be able to go to China? It's so far, it's so expensive. We're never going to be able to go, so this is a good opportunity.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Champaign County, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. On that issue, many Vietnam vets have gone back to Indochina to see what's left of what they wrought. But the earlier caller mentioned the analogy that Bush's speechwriter brought up to Vietnam, and it seems to me that one should ask him, Bush himself, if he wanted to extend the Vietnam War so he could use some of that training on that outmoded jet that he was defending San Antonio against the Vietnamese with. But that's an aside. Actually, I wanted to ask you about Korea. That's another place where the Marines went and was only a few years later. I heard a figure that 30% of the population of Korea was killed in the short war of the Korean War. And we know, there was another thing on Vietnam, which is germane to what you just said that about the overtures. Of course, Eisenhower, who campaigned on getting the U.S. out of Korea, then did not accept a plebiscite in Indochina. So, the speechwriters also brought up I.F. Stone, which I think the hidden history of the Korean War is worth looking at again. That was contemporaneously written and has a great introduction by Bruce Cummings, who I think is also be a good person to have on this subject. I don't know if he has a recent book to chat on, but he's not in the Rolodex because he has some divergent views, and I'd like to hear some of those after hearing what I regard here as more straight ahead. I mean, grand area strategy preceded World War II, and though we didn't want colonialism of the European style, we certainly wanted to integrate large regions of the world into the Pax Americanas and the economic structure that we were anticipating. If you would address some of those, I guess you can pick and choose since there's so many.
It's hard to know where to start except to briefly talk about I.F. Stone because, of course, he had many admirers in the 60s and 70s when he used to write his column and get inside information almost single-handedly. However, it's pretty clear now since we have lots of records from the Soviet side and the Chinese side that he was totally wrong on Vietnam. The North Koreans wanted to invade the South and unify the country. They didn't get a go-ahead for a while from the Soviets, and they only persuaded the Soviets in 1950 to let them go ahead with this. And also at that point, Mao Zedong endorsed this invasion. I think Stalin believed that this could be done and that the Americans would not react in the way they did because, after all, the Americans had lost China and not done anything about it, so why should they worry about South Korea? So Stalin decided that he could give in to the persistent nagging by Kim Il-sung and let him go ahead with this invasion of South Korea.
I'm sticking with I don't accept that Stone was wrong about Vietnam, but the hidden history of the Korean War, which, as you say, was written contemporaneously, talks about the way the
I'm sorry, the war I was talking about Korea. That's what I was talking about is Korea.
Ah, well, you said Vietnam.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have said Korea.
Right. Well, he was looking at contemporaneous documents, and I don't know. It's the U.S. side that I think needs to be examined critically.
We are examining us historians in the Historians Union. We are examining the U.S. side too, and at George Washington, for instance. We have a program called the International Cold War History Project that involves a number of scholars in different countries, including some of the countries that were formerly part of the Soviet-influenced area, and that we're working on with those scholars to find documents, especially regarding Cold War crises of various kinds. And
yeah, you don't have to be a member of a union to go to this website. I have been there, so.
Oh, okay, you've been there. All right, great. Well, then I'd recommend that other people go there if they want to look at what the present thinking is about various crises and policies of the Cold War.
Let me. I have another caller here. I want to try to get to just in though. At what point in the thinking, particularly in the United States, did concerns about Soviet expansionism and the growth of communism in Asia become an important factor in the formulation of policy? American policy in the region. Did that was how early on after the war?
It seemed to be a factor as far as Korea was concerned. It seemed to be a factor by the end of the war. I think one specific thing that influenced Washington thinking, that is, thinking of Washington insiders. Was the Soviets' negotiations with Chiang Kai-shek's government on a treaty of, I think it was called Treaty of Friendship and Commerce or something like that, that was supposed to follow on the end of the war, and basically the Soviets would recognize the nationalist government. And the nationalists would make various concessions to the Soviets, and the American ambassador, who was present in Moscow during this time, decided that the Soviets really were bent on expansion. That this was a sign that they really wanted to take over northern China and Manchuria. So that was one thing that set off. Concern, but even before then, there was concern not to let the Soviets, for instance, occupy all of Korea.
Let's make sure we get to this last caller here, at least one we have now in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, quite apart from the right or wrong of our intervention in Korea, and I would suspect, think that we perhaps were justified there. The claim of President Bush that it led directly to a democratic Korea, it seems to me, is fallacious. Korea evolved to a democracy, but it took another 20 or 30 years. And
I think if Bush wanted to be literal about history, as far as Korea is concerned, he would have said something like, well, our resolute defense of South Korea led directly to years of military dictatorship. But that was good because that eventually evolved into democracy. I don't think that would have gone over as well, though.
No. And the claim for Japan having been established in democracy, really, Japan still isn't a democracy. It's a one-party system.
Well,
and not very different from the one we overthrew at the end of the Second World War.
Well, no, Japan, I think, is much more pluralistic than the people running the there is an elite that more or less runs things in Japan, just as you could argue maybe there's an elite in the U.S., but it's much more pluralistic than in the pre-war period, and it's a different set of groups. You don't have the emperor anymore. You don't have the army and navy who were...
Well, the emperor's still there. He didn't have any power before, and he doesn't have any power now.
He's not a political player, and we now know that he was a political player. The emperor and his and the court, his court advisors, played a big role in pre-war Japanese politics, and you don't have that anymore. On the other hand, you have... increased role of business. You have political parties play an increased role, the media. So you have some different groups. The Army and Navy certainly don't have a whole lot of influence.
Well, the not reestablishing the Army as it had been prior to the Second World War certainly benefited the Japanese people, I think. That was perhaps the one thing MacArthur did that was foresighted. And as for your statement that it, in a sense, is not a complete democracy here, I would completely accept that. And that perhaps Bush would like to see a government very similar to the Japanese where business rules, I think, might be very close to his definition of democracy in this country. Well, you're very interesting, and thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have a couple of minutes left here, Professor Spector. I'm reaching for a kind of a general point that we can finish on, talking about general lessons also, or understandings that we can take away from this, aside from the one thing that we mentioned where you were talking about occupations being very difficult, and particularly difficult if you have people going into, occupiers going into places where they are under-equipped, understaffed, and where they don't really understand the people that they're occupying. We definitely have seen recently that play out again. Are there some other important lessons, do you think, that emerge from taking a look at this period, and particularly, you know, you contrast those places where occupation was, where at least people were not worse off than they were, and making comparisons between those kinds of places where indeed people were worse off, because you do make the point that there were people in this immediate post-war period that actually suffered much more and much worse than during the time that the war was actually going on.
Yeah, well, I have to say that luck and chance come into this to a great extent. The Indonesians were very lucky that they were fighting for independence against the Dutch, say, instead of against, say, the Soviets or the British or the Americans. Also, they were very lucky in that the Cold War, once it started up in earnest in 48-49, inclined the Americans to support independence, to support the Republican government in Indonesia, because not because that government looked particularly pro-American, but because it had survived and put down an attempted communist coup. So as far as the Americans were concerned, well, that's enough.
Well, I suppose then that also would point to something that people would point to as our tendency there and elsewhere to support, in the interest of anti-communism, to support regimes that were perhaps not democratic or had a fundamental respect for human rights, but they're not communists. They have a strong anti-communist position. They have defeated communist movements. So in the interest of limiting the spread of communism, we will support those governments. That's the kind of thing that I suppose...
Well, after 1950, yeah. After the fall of... Before 1950, there's lots of people in Washington, influential people, who don't want to get involved in Southeast Asia at all. After 1950, with the fall of China, then there is this concern to make sure that... none of these other countries in Asia fall to communism, and therefore they start looking at regimes that they think can survive pressure from China.
So had not been for the Cold War, then or particularly at least what happened in China then, that it sounds as if sort of a major orientation in American foreign policy might not have been there at all.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think Americans basically were looking towards Europe, and that's where they thought the important arena of the Cold War was located. But with the fall of China, so-called, then they had no choice but to try to make sure that didn't happen again in some form in Asia.
Did the Russians at the beginning, did they see the Chinese communists as potential allies from the start?
Well, formally, the Chinese communists and the Soviets were always allies. That is, you know, ideologically and in principle and in their statements. But Stalin was always willing in 1945-46 to sacrifice the interests of the Chinese communists if he can get a better deal from Chiang Kai-shek. And I don't think Stalin expected that the Chinese communists could actually win a civil war in China.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. If you would like to read more on this period of history, the book to look for is In the Ruins of Empire, The Japanese Surrender and the Battle for Postwar Asia. Our guest is Ronald Spector. He's professor of history and international relations at George Washington University, where, among other things, he teaches courses on U.S. East Asia relations, World War II, and the Vietnam War. Professor Spector, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.